This audio recording is under copyright protection, all rights reserved. Any duplication, transmission, or broadcast without permission is strictly prohibited by U.S. and international laws.
As you have noted, we are engaging here in the tip of the iceberg of the study of gelotology. Gelotology is the study of the effects and health benefits of the kinds of humor and the effects and health benefits of humor. And I thought you might enjoy this because it always makes you feel good to have some little bit of trivia that you can dump on someone and say, yes, I went to a lecture on gelotology, and they're, what's that? I've never heard of it. And you can just eloquently and fluently explain. I, of course, had no clue what this word meant until yesterday. And I already seem smarter as a result of having learned it. But I have long noted that there is something very, very powerful in humor, in teaching, that makes a world of difference. We all, I think, have, at least, I don't know, we all, I'll speak for myself, and you can decide whether you two share this experience, profoundly fuzzy, unclear memories of almost all of my time in school. And those few, you know, lasting memories, you can say, well, I remember that thing in third grade, or that thing in fifth grade, or that teacher in eighth grade, and the rest of it's just a blur for me. Now, there could be reasons that I'm more blurred than most people about my school life, but if we pinpoint those things we actually remember and actually learn something, they seem to almost always be connected with profound pain or humor. That those are the two elements that create an intensity whereby learning is made more easy. I also, as I began to teach music, and most of my adult career has been spent, well, actually it used to be true, now it's about half and half, but about half my adult career was spent teaching violin and kinder music with young children. And as I began to teach younger children more often, I realized that they thrive on laughter. That when they are laughing, things go well and smoothly, and you're all happy, and everybody seems to be learning and productive. And when there's no laughter, you just get into a hole very quickly with young children. You can seem to survive the hole more with older kids who've been trained or flogged to pretend to pay attention, right? But there's just something so incredibly powerful about the chuckles, the humor. And I learned this by hanging out with little children who are very intolerant of things that are not relevant and don't have an intensity that engages them. So I think I started my kind of informal study of how to be humorous, forced into running a preschool all day, every day. This was me with children 3.5, 4.5, and 5.5 years old from 9 in the morning until 2:30 in the afternoon. For 2 years I did this. And I think that was it. After that, I had become kind of naturally able to be humorous with children. I am quite sure, as a matter of fact, that being humorous is a learnable, teachable, studyable, transferable skill. That although you may have friends and you say, well, he's just such a funny person to be around. Yes, he may have a natural aptitude for this or that, for music or for humor or for engaging conversation or for basketball. Everybody has a natural aptitude. But no matter where you start, you can always improve your skill. And so even if you sit there and say, well, I'm just not a naturally funny person, I challenge you. You can become a more humorous, engaging teacher if you choose to do so. My job is twofold. Number one, to convince you more firmly as to why this would improve your teaching and your quality of life in general. And number two, give you some concrete things to look for in the world, in the circumstances, when you want to create, if you will, more humor in the environment. So first of all, I'm just going to review some things which you probably are subconsciously or semi-consciously aware of just by reading Reader's Digest and things like that, if you read Reader's Digest, which is by far the best magazine published in the world today. Humor and laughter, in particular, has a very concrete, tangible, physiological result. When people laugh, it causes a release of endorphins in the brain. This is scientifically verified. And endorphins, as you know, are the types of chemicals, neurotransmitters, that chemically are very similar to morphine. So if you look at the structure of the endorphins and the morphine, they're very similar types of chemical structures and have a similar effect. And what they are is essentially natural painkillers. So far as we know, nobody has had to go into recovery program because of being addicted to laughter and endorphins. You also, by the way, get endorphins in another way, which is putting the check marks on the checklist. You may have heard that in my seminar. You know, you love those checklists because you've got your checklist. I did this morning, believe it or not. I had my little checklist of things Julie Walker was telling me I had to do all day, and I actually did something that I knew I was supposed to do but wasn't on my checklist. I wrote it in. I checked it off. I'm going to throw that thing away. I don't need a record of what I did. Like some girls keep a diary, I just throw them all away. But I don't know. There was just something about today I thought endorphins will help subconsciously, you know. And you've got this effect of lowering the stress, lowering the blood pressure. Also, when you have the endorphins and the side effects of laughter, which include actually better respiration as well. When you get a good, strong laugh, you're just kind of forced to take deeper breaths so you can continue the thing. Otherwise, you asphyxiate, and you can't laugh, and you can't breathe, and you, if that situation continued indefinitely, you would die. So you are forced to breathe deeper. You also find that laughter has a measurable scientific effect on the immune system. I actually believe this is one reason why I get sick very seldom, much less than anyone in my family, certainly my wife or my children. In fact, I get sick less than anyone I know. Now, up until recently, I have ascribed this great, immune system to my compelling need to eat hot peppers and hot sauce all the time. You know, that if I can take in, you know, enough jalapenos and enough garlic and occasional habanero and liberal doses of Tabasco, that's what keeps me so healthy. So everybody around me is, you know, falling apart with in bed, with throwing up, with a fever, and I'm just charging forward. But I started to wonder, maybe it's not entirely just the hot sauce, but the fact that I am constantly in this effort to keep myself chuckling and keep the people around me chuckling. I don't know, but I do know that this laughter strengthens your immune system, and it strengthens your heart, and it increases your attentiveness because it pulls up your pulse a little bit. Now, isn't that fascinating? It lowers your stress and blood pressure while it pulls up your pulse. Doesn't that sound like the ideal circumstance? Because who wants to be, you know, high blood pressure and then you have to take these drugs that just knock you out, you can't do anything. But nobody wants to be, you know, wired all the time because it's too stressful. It's almost as though nature and God have designed this laughter to be the perfect medicine. Of course, Reader's Digest started telling you that 100 years before I ever came on the scene. And we've all read this many stories. I remember just a couple years ago reading this one. Here's this guy with terminal cancer. It's hopeless, right? The doctors say, you will die. Chemotherapy won't work. No chance for you. And he cured himself entirely of cancer in 6 months by doing this. He quit his job, and every day he stayed home and watched I Love Lucy reruns all day long, just forcing himself to laugh constantly. Now, I don't know, I'd say he's smart in one way, but stupid in another, because let's face it, if you're smart enough to try that type of alternative medicine, you've got some brains, but if you can laugh all day at I Love Lucy, I'm a little worried about you. However, I think it was that the joke, you know, even the slapstick silly nature of it, it sparks the ability to laugh, and then that kind of can persist. Once you know, when you were a kid, things would start happening, and you would start laughing, and you would just keep laughing. You would go into kind of these endorphic convulsions of laughter and bliss, and it was so funny and so fun to laugh. You and your friend would just keep trying to laugh as long. It was almost, you know, kind of like being on drugs. You were in an alternative reality for the duration of the laugh. And so this idea then of the health benefits is well documented. Now, when I started to plan a lecture on humor, I had no idea. But there are dozens, probably hundreds of people, PhDs, whose whole life is dedicated to the study of humor. There is a guy, he's a professor at Stanford, and this is his whole thing. He's a professor of linguistics, and he's one of the world experts on what makes things funny. And I read an article he had written, and I could not understand a thing about it. It was written in PhD-ese, which had all of this, you know, logic theory and humor theory, and I thought, how can a guy who studied humor his whole life write so awful stuff that isn't even amusing? But I thought, well, isn't that interesting? There also happens to be, by the way, the International Humor Studies Association, right? And they have this huge convention in New York every year. Thousands of people come from all over the world to present their papers and their studies about the health effects and the psychological effects and the ways and the logic of and everything related to humor. I am so tempted to go to this convention because I think it's a great, it's kind of like when you discover, you know, a whole thing you never knew existed and you like the edge of the forest or the, you know, the first thing in the box. You just want to dive in and try to pull it all out. And so we know this. Now, we also know that humor has emotional benefits. This has been researched and presented, the scientific benefits of humor in when you have a stressful situation, people have anger or irritation at each other. If they laugh together, then it just dissipates. And so clinical studies, I won't get into the details, have been done on circumstances like this where they take people's kind of irritation level and then they put them in a situation where they can laugh and then they interview them and their irritation level has gone way down. So whenever you are having an irritation moment, which I don't know, in my life it happens once every few months, my family, that I get irritated with someone. Now, I think they get irritated with me a whole lot more frequently, but whatever, you try to diffuse the thing by some little bit of humor, it bonds. There's two basic theories of what makes humor, two basic theories of what makes people laugh. The first basic theory is that there's an incongruence between expectation and reality. That's the first basic theory. The second basic theory of laughter is that it is a shared relief of stress. And those two seem to both be valid. This incongruence of expectation and reality is really what we're going to deal with when we get into, in a little bit, the study of the elements of humor that I have found so far. And I'm quite sure, as I mentioned, this is a great treasure chest, and I've only pulled out the first few things on it. But it's very, very hard, if not impossible, to be angry, depressed, resentful, or anxious at the same time that you're laughing. Wouldn't you say? I mean, you could be, you know, angry one minute and laughing the next. It could happen, you know, sequentially. But it's very hard to pull the emotion of being angry into the time while you're laughing, etc., with depressed and resentful. And when you are, like me, a naturally melancholic, pessimistic person, and I really am, I am just left to my own devices wandering around all day, I would become profoundly melancholic, and if I had any access to the news, which I'm unfortunately addicted, I would become pessimistic and depressed so quickly. So for me, humor is a survival skill. I figured this out. Not everybody. They're kind of more optimistic. They don't see you know, the end of the world around the corner like I do. So they may not have the desperate need for it. But while people are laughing, the dominant emotions that come out are pleasure, peace, love, joy, mirth, happiness. Now, many of us have heard this idea that the average five-year-old laughs 300 times a day, and the average 40-year-old laughs only 50 times a day, or 50, or depends, there's different study. However, I recently read a new study, which was more scientific, debunking this fact, that some children laugh 300 or 3,000 times a day, but not all five-year-olds do. And some adults may laugh only 15 times a day, but not all. So I think somebody maybe created this statistic, because, of course, 67% of all statistics are just made up. wherever we are on the laugh-o-meter scale, we want to come up. Now, an interesting thing that I did find, and this was a study, these are all very scientific studies. I don't know if you'd get crabby doing scientific studies about something that should be fun and spontaneous, but this one I read said you are 30 times more likely to laugh when other people are around. Now, that's kind of odd because, you know, you read something funny, and if there's nobody around, you could laugh freely, but you're not likely to. Whereas if you read something to someone and they laugh, you're much more likely to laugh at the thing if it was funny. I've got this thing that is so funny, I am going to, it will be dangerously funny when I read this to you. Because last night, I was reading this to Webster, and he, I thought, was going to go into spasm and die on me. And finally he said, stop reading this thing. And so I thought, I wonder if actually humor, too much of it, could be dangerous. So this morning I did a bit of quick research, and I discovered the Tanzanian laughter epidemic. This actually happened in 1962. This group of high school students, right? Something happened. Nobody even knows what started this great thing, but something happened, and this group of students began laughing. And pretty soon, all the people around them were laughing. And pretty soon, they went back to their classrooms, and all the people in all the classrooms, the whole school was starting to laugh uncontrollably and couldn't stop. And so they quit school for the day and sent everybody home. But this made it much worse, because now all the people in the homes were starting to laugh, and pretty soon, the whole country of Tanzania, which had just recently acquired its freedom, you know, its independence from Britain, The whole country was laughing. People were stumbling into the hospital with uncontrollable laughter, having abdominal pains and respiratory problems and uncontrollable weeping and rashes. And this thing continued where people were laughing around the country for 6 months. They were having medical diagnosis. Uncontrollable laughter was the cause of the malady. So I thought, all right, we have to be careful. Because if we start a Tanzanian laughter epidemic, it was really quite the phenomena. It's the worst humor disaster that has ever occurred. And so once we get very good at this, we've got to then use our power wisely, lest we cause an unexpected pain. Also, studies on organizational performance have come to find out that in laughter, you get an increased participation of people, increased expressions of trust and likability, clearly an increase of teamwork. You divide people into teams and, you know, so often, especially in schools, you create a little team and, okay, you guys are going to go do this. It's usually one person who does the whole thing and everybody just sits there and, well, he's smarter than me and I can't really contribute here. But if you can get the laughter going, then there's increased teamwork happening and increased creativity. And so from an organizational and social social analysis, there's those benefits. So far we have the health benefits, the emotional benefits, the organizational benefits, and then of course there's the educational benefits. One which fascinates me because I have a background in child brain development is that all people, regardless of sex, regardless of being male or female, laughter stimulates neurons in both half of the hemispheres of the brain, and it's universal. Now, this is important and interesting because we learned in Dr. Sachs's, how many have heard my talk, Teaching Boys and Other Kids Would Rather Be Making Forts All Day? That's definitely worth listening to. It's a $3 download. You can burn it to CD. You can give a copy to all your friends. It's a very, very important talk. And in the first half of the book, I present the research of Dr. Leonard Sachs on the gender differences, the neurophysiological differences between males and females, and how this is so significant in our teaching. But one of the studies, which gives everyone a chuckle, at least the women, is that in a study evaluating the listening to audiobooks of men and women, it's discovered that almost all women listen to audiobooks using both hemispheres of their cortex, whereas most men listen to audiobooks firing only in their dominant or language side of the brain, which of course confirms which many wives knew long ago, that most men are using half their brain when they're listening most of the time. But if it's an absolute necessity that you fire if you fire neurons in both hemispheres of your cortex when you're laughing, then to keep people laughing will keep them actually listening better, not just because it's attentive and they're looking forward to the next joke, but because neurologically it's stimulating part of the brain. And this is probably even more important for boys neurologically because of that habit. I have been amazed at the power of our video seminar. To be quite honest, when we started this thing back, I gave the first seminar in Seattle in 1994, December 1994. I had to drive over the Cascade Mountains with chains on my truck going 20 miles an hour. It was horrible. I remember the horrible weather, and I remember the seminar. And after that first seminar, someone said, you should videotape your seminar. And I thought, that is the stupidest idea. You know, only a completely ignorant teacher, you know, non-teacher, could suggest this. Because any teacher would know that when you teach, you've got to look at people. You've got to see their face. You've got to see their nodding. Because how can you know the next thing to say if you don't know that they've got what you just said? So I just scoffed at this idea. And this guy called me back and said, look, you know, here, let's just do it, right? It won't cost you a thing. And then anyone who wants to buy it, if they buy it from me, I'll make money. And if they want to buy it from you, you can sell it to them and you can make money. So with complete skepticism, we recorded the first video seminar of our writing program, of me teaching Webster's syllabus. And I looked at these videos and I thought, this is the most awful thing I have seen in my life. I look like a goon. The camera is awful. You know, I'm walking out of the frame constantly because they couldn't train me to stay in one place back then. And I thought, this is so bad. I would never sell this to anybody. So people would call me up and say, well, my friend came to a seminar of yours that you did in Portland, and I live in New Mexico, and she said you have videotapes. And I would say, no. You do not want to buy these videotapes. You just wait till I come to New Mexico, and we'll teach it to you the right way. And that was my attitude for quite a while. And the first set was so bad, within a year we had to redo it, because there was no way I was going to sell that. The second set was awful. I don't know. Some of you may actually have come across this thing. It was the pre-2000 videos. And then I was getting calls from people saying, well, we learned all this from your seminar. That's a isolated miracle, that there was a person who could watch a video of me teaching and get anything out of it at all. And then the isolated miracles became fewer. And finally, they convinced me to video the student classes. Now, I thought that absolutely would never work. You cannot teach a group of children unless you can see them and stimulate them so that you know that they're paying attention. So I went in with, again, total skepticism. I said, well, an adult can watch a video, but never a kid. Well, okay. 10 years later, I walk up to go to a convention. 10-year-old kid walked up to me, 12-year-old kid, 15-year-old kid, 7-year-old kid, and they want my autograph. They want to shake my hand. They want to take a picture with me. They said, oh, I watch your videos, and I love them. Now, if I ask them a question, why do you like them? 9 times out of 10, you're funny. You're funny. And then if they're old enough, they'll say, and you really helped me with my writing, and I'm doing really good. But that's the initial reaction. And so somehow I developed this ability to interact with children and know what would work for them, know what would make them laugh, confident enough to go ahead and put that thing on video. And now people say, oh, you know, my kid talks to the television. You know, my children wave their hands in the room. How come he's not calling on me? There's something very engaging about this thing. And so I really believe the Webster Writing Program would stand on its own. I mean, you could have someone emotionlessly, you know, humorlessly, scientifically teach this thing. Some adults could learn it and teach it, and it would still work because the system is inherently effective. But with the children, I am very much convinced that I disarm them right away. And a lot of them, I hate writing, and then I tell some kind of subtle little joke, and they chuckle, and I say, oh, it's going to be painful and torturous. And then they go, wait a minute, that breaks my paradigm. That's an incongruence between my expectation and the reality of it. Right? I would expect the teacher to say, oh, it's going to be so fun, and I know it won't be. But this guy says it's going to be miserable and painful. Immediately, there's something building here. There's the chuckle. There's the laughter element. There's the trust, right? So now if it is painful, at least, you know, there was honesty between us. And some teacher comes and says, oh, it's going to be so fun. Well, for the kid who knows it's not easy, then for the kid who already likes writing, then you've immediately created this little contest. Well, I can prove to him that I have a good time when I, you know, all these things going on. So fascinating. So my experience has shown me that our success in this business of selling videos and transforming kids is so connected up with the ability to inject the humor. So I would like to go over some of the elements of humor so that when you want to or you feel so inclined, this might spark an idea to do something that would be spontaneously humorous. Now, you can also study jokes, and I've done this. I have studied jokes. I have put memorized jokes. I would start my class always with a joke because I discovered it was the absolute best way to get everybody there on time. Right? I mean, you get you and we give away a prize, but for a little group of kids, if they know there's going to be a joke happening right at 8:30, they will move heaven and earth to get their mom out the door and on the road. They'll even find their shoes, you know, so they don't have to be told to, because they want that joke. It's amazing. So if you're in a situation where you need to get people in there attentive, ready to go, and they expect you, and I used to have, I still do, I have in my bag, I carry it everywhere I go, because you never know when you might need it, right along with my money and my travel cards and all that. I have this little keyword outline of many dozens of jokes, right? And it's just that all you need to do is put two or three keywords of the punchline, and then it will remind you of the whole joke. So, for example, I've got how scrambled. Those two words remind me of an entire joke, which I can spin into almost a semi nonfiction kind of story, and I end up with this punchline, right? And so I haven't told this joke probably for a great long time, maybe 6 months or a year, but because I've got the punchline in keywords, it works. Or sometimes you just need the characters. I can tell three jokes and instantly understand the intellectual capacity of a group of children, at least the majority, by which ones look blank and which ones look lost. And then I actually will kind of automatically change my sophistication, the vocabulary, the type of humor, the level or depth of explanation that I will give on things. I adjust it instantly, almost subconsciously, because I've been at this for a while, if I tell a joke and I see the reaction. So I can actually judge that. So when someone kind of says, I don't get that one, you just look around for a simpler joke. And, then you try one that's it's a little less subtle, but it's still, kind of subtle. And you say, little Billy said to his mom, Mom, I want to grow up and be a drummer. And his mom said, oh, Billy, I'm so sorry. You can't do both. Okay, but he didn't smile. So either he's a drummer or he's just a really hard guy to get to smile. But okay, then you say, all right, now there's the level of inference I can make. But I've got this, and you know what's so funny? I have actually, by the end of 4-day student writing intensive, you tell jokes the first day. And then the second day, you tell some more jokes. Now the third day, they are ready for these jokes. And they're frustrated a bit because they went home and they tried to tell the jokes to their dad, but they couldn't remember. So now on the third day, right, what have you been teaching them the first 2 days? How to take a keyword outline. I have actually have kids intuit that if they would take a keyword outline of the jokes I'm telling, they could get the thing home intact and tell it to their dad, and he would actually laugh because it was funny, not out of politeness. And so I thought, well, now that's even better than saying, okay, kids, we're going to give a lecture, and now you're going to, take notes on it, which you could do. But for them to discover on their own that if you take keywords from the thing and tell the joke, it works so much better. So the idea then of finding conscious ways, like collecting up jokes and practicing them, and then spur-of-the-moment opportunities to be funny. One of the simplest, oldest, and easiest ways to be funny, and this works better with young children. So the younger they are, the more likely this particular type of humor is to work, is what we would call physical humor. It usually involves unpredictable actions. And again, thinking about incongruence between expectation and reality. So I'm wearing a tie and a suit. There's a certain expectation little children might have for my behavior. So when I'm teaching the sea wasp and you get this jellyfish that's going to cause you to, you know, become completely paralyzed and die within seconds of being stung, I will usually, in the class, pick the boy who needs the most, and I will be sure he's sitting in the front row, and I will dramatize this, and you see wasp, and you feel something's wrong, and it expands up your arm, and your nervous system starts to contract, and you're staggering to the shore, and I'll fall right on the table, right in his lap, right? Now he feels special, but everybody is just, they're just howling with laughter because they wouldn't expect me to do that. Now, if I was dressed in a clown suit, it wouldn't be nearly as funny because it wouldn't be as much of this incongruence between expectation and reality. And so physical humor with young children can be very, very effective, and it's very easy. I find it just a constant thing. And sometimes you say something, and then you pay the price. My granddaughter, Kaya, she's 8. She's 9 months different from my own daughter, and they are over at our house frequently. And so Kaya's sitting there, and she's the pickiest eater. I mean, her mother has not trained her to eat stuff she doesn't like. And so she had this plate of carrots, and we're trying to get her to eat the carrots, and she's not doing it. And so I finally said, you know, Kaya, if you ate all those carrots, I would be so shocked. I would fall off my chair. All right. Now, what happens? She eats all these carrots, pointing every time she's eating. Pappy, I ate a few more carrots. Pappy. And pretty soon, Pappy, all the carrots are gone. Oh, now I have to fall off the chair. Which at my age is not nearly as much fun as it might have been once. So I carefully figure out how am I going to fall off and not hurt myself too bad and make a big scene of it. So I thought, oh, this is a big mistake. Because now, every time she's at our house for dinner, she says, well, if I ate all this corn, would you fall off your chair? And if I ate all this, you know, chocolate cake, I bet you'd fall off your chair. So that physical humor can be very entertaining, and the desire for the laughter can be very motivating, even when it involves eating carrots. Now, personally, I would not eat these carrots to see someone fall off their chair. I would need something much bigger, you know, like a $100 bill or something. But anyway, all right, so that's one. All right, another form of humor, which is very natural to children, very natural. I'm trying to work up from kind of the most natural to the more sophisticated, is misunderstandings. The reason, of course, is because children themselves are so often misunderstood. And so it's a way of poking fun at yourself. And so when you present to them some of these misunderstandings that are similar to what they've done, there's not only the humor, but there's also the affirmation that mistakes can be okay, that's not the end of the world. And that kind of thing is funny. Sometimes you get people who have really unintentional misunderstanding. I mean, some of the funniest typos you read, you know, in the 19th century Russia, the pheasants led terrible lives. The peasants were happy as heck, but the poor birds were miserable. Or sometimes you get a confusion of words, right? You know there's a word, and you give it your best shot to find that word, but it's actually a different one that you found, and it comes out rather humorous, again, because the expectation and the reality. A triangle of 135 degrees is called an obscene triangle. Now you're knowing, okay, it's ob something, and you just can't keep it straight. And so children can, you know, this can happen to them. So when you put it out in a way that they can relate, it's a comforting thing. Okay, you know, everybody makes mistakes, you know. A virtuoso, of course, you know what a virtuoso is, don't you? A musician with very high morals. Now, another thing which works very effectively for young children is impossible absurdities. There is a whole genre of jokes that are based on this. The visual image presented is so absurd that it is funny. You just don't even know why. I mean, it's stupidly funny, but it is funny, and so funny always trumps stupid, right? I mean, if I said, I'm going to tell you a stupid joke, would you like it or not? You'd probably say, okay, fine. Because the potential for the humor and all those side benefits of the emotional and physical and mental improvement outweighs the danger of the absurdity or the stupidity. So some of these, you know, they just don't make sense. And they never, and that's what it does. You wouldn't think them funny. If you said, I'm going to create a joke this way, you'd say, well, that'll never work. But then you try it, and it does. My friend had a pet elephant. It got lost in his apartment. It's there somewhere, but he can't find it. Okay, now that's not your majorly funny thing, but somebody laughed. Why? Because the idea of having a pet elephant is absurd. The idea of having it in your apartment is even more absurd. And then the triple pattern, having this elephant in your apartment and you can't find it. Now that's even, that hits an apex of absurdity. And by then that joke had better be over. So there's this whole genre of, you know, how do you put a giraffe in the refrigerator? You know these? Oh, I tell you, 10-year-old boys, they can just go with this forever. How do you put a giraffe in a refrigerator? Open the door and put it in. Close the door, right? How do you put an elephant in the refrigerator? Open the door, pull out the giraffe, put the elephant. You know, all right. So I don't generally do those kinds of jokes in mixed audience because, of course, they are hilariously funny to some people and they're just dumb to other people. So they're not quite as good. Now, moving up the scale here a little bit in what children find attractive would be the kind of thing I try to stay away from. It's hard to stay away from it entirely, but I think it's good to downplay it as much as possible. And that would be derogation and caricature. It's the laughing at someone else's expense kind of joke. And really, the only type of humor here that is acceptable to me, in truth, is self-derogation, right? Self-caricature. So when you point out your weakness strongly, then people will laugh. Because there's a disconnect between the expectation and the reality. And I say, well, you know, I'm very bad at something or whatever. And then people say, oh, you couldn't be that bad. And so there's that disconnect there. Sometimes you do just find that there's these derogation and character jokes. They're just too good. They're just so good, you can't let them go. I try to stick away from those unless they're completely safe, and then you're in pretty good shape. Now, the next type of humor, going up the scale, is probably something that I appreciate the most. So when I hear something that I like, that makes me laugh, I try to imitate it from time to time. And one of my favorite categories is stating the obvious in an unexpected way, right? You're stating the obvious in an unexpected way. G.K. Chesterton wrote a book called The Napoleon of Notting Hill. And the first sentence in this book reads thus. The human race, to which so many of my readers belong, has been playing at children's games from the beginning. And he goes on. And you just, it's like, duh. But for some reason, it's kind of funny. It's stating the obvious in an unexpected way. you see this often. You know, I expected to enjoy the film, but that was before I saw it. Okay, I mean, it makes perfect sense. It's obviously true, but it's got that element of humor because it comes upon you unexpectedly. All right, going up in, I don't know if this is up, this might be down, but it takes a little bit of skill to do it well. So in that way, it's a bit more sophisticated. Hyperbole and exaggeration. There is a poet out there. Perhaps some of you have come across Jack Prelutsky. Jack Prelutsky. He's a children's poet, and he writes books. I find that they get old pretty fast because he uses one type of humor for the whole, for everything. Every poem he's written that's funny seems to depend on this one type of humor. But children don't tire of it quite as fast as I do. And it would be the hyperbole or exaggeration. So he's got a poem about, you know, the little girl who wouldn't empty the trash. And then pretty soon, or I'm sure it was a boy who wouldn't empty the trash. Somebody wouldn't empty the trash, and so then it overflows, and it's in the house, and then it's in the garden, and then it's in the city, and pretty soon the whole world is covered with trash. This has, again, the absurd quality, because that could never happen, and yet the hyperbole of it. His little poem, Homework, is cute. Homework, oh, homework, I hate you, you stink. I wish I could wash you right down the sink. You know, I wish... if I had a bomb, I'd blow you to bits. So homework, oh, homework, you're giving me fits. You know, children can relate, and that feeling of I'd like to blow the thing up, so it has. And I use hyperbole a bit. One of the dangers of using hyperbole in an adult type of setting is that you can also be accused of generalization. Well, what am I doing? I'm creating a picture. I'm making a statistical and, I believe, valid generalization. And I'm using hyperbole to draw people in with a bit of the humor, and everybody can relate to it. Well, maybe your kid doesn't write 18 pages, but, you know, can go on for 3 or 4. Maybe the boy wouldn't scrub all the toilets, but he, you know, sure rather scrub the floor. So, so it creates a range which people can step into. But that type of humor for us will sometimes run the danger of putting us into a zone of being offensive by generalization. And I say to the teacher, you know, I am so sorry. I'm not stereotyping. I don't believe all girls are like this and all boys like that. But in my experience, when people tell me about their children, most of the time that's the way it is. So I have to actually adjust that depending on who I'm talking to. But the hyperbole and exaggeration, I would say, is not necessarily one of my favorites unless it's combined with some other purpose or some other element. I am more likely myself, probably by nature of being a pessimist and a melancholic, to lean toward the opposite extreme, which is another form of humor called understatement. Is when you understate something, and it's just, again, a disconnect between expectation and reality. Here would be a couple examples. If at first you don't succeed, skydiving is not for you. You're never supposed to laugh at your own jokes. But I like that one because you're like, if at first you don't succeed, you know, whatever's going to come next. And then there's this image of, you know, skydiving. You better get it right the first time. Understatement, because the consequences are so severe, right? So that understatement... I kind of have a little bit of a more natural propensity or attraction to that type of humor. And then being a word person, being primarily a guy who's been fascinated with language my whole life, I like the puns. I like the plays on word, the double meanings, the pronunciation games, the double entendre type of thing quite a bit. And this is a little bit harder to spontaneously fit in, but when it does, you just feel such a sense of brilliance. It's dangerous. You could get, you know, haughty and proud. So you've always got to be sure, when you engage in the study of humor, to hang out with someone who is much better at it than you are. lest you think that you're good. And so things like there's this little, you know, sign on the power company door. We are delighted when you pay your bill on time, and you will be if you're not, if you don't. Right? And you've got that double entendre of delighted or delighted. And it takes a bit to work the wording out, and what does that mean? And you go, oh, that's pretty clever. Sign on the optometrist door. If you don't see what you're looking for, you're in the right place. It's almost as though some of these forms of humor are nice ways to kind of meditate or reflect on some of life's lessons in a way. And so I believe that you actually can improve intelligence in children by helping them develop a more sophisticated sense of humor. If not raw intelligence, certainly applied or humor-based intelligence. The thing that was sending me into these convulsions of endorphic panic with Webster, and I was taking almost a sick pleasure in torturing him, because he would finally get over one of these, and then I would read the next one, and he would just erupt into an even greater thing. And it's like one of those things when you're going downhill, if you don't slow down enough and you start up again, you're now going faster and faster. And I didn't give him enough breathing room in between. So by the time he finally had got enough oxygen to survive, I was reading another one, because I actually thought that he would enjoy using these in his talk on advanced decorations. And I don't know, some of you may have got these. They were traveling about the internet for a while, and I used a few of them in the student writing intensive class. But these are similes by high school students. So when the teacher says, you have to do a simile, only don't give me any cliches. Right? I don't want, you know, jumping like a kangaroo or as clever as a fox. You come up with something original. So then the kids are just scanning their brain for any possible thing that they could connect up. And so here's just a few of these things. Her face was a perfect oval, like a circle that had its two sides gently compressed by a thigh master. His thoughts tumbled in his head, making and breaking alliances, like underpants in a dryer without cling free. I mean, that's kind of good when you think about it. I guess it's, you know, the underpants part. Socks wouldn't have been quite as absurd. And now, as I'm reading these, you might reflect on the list of 10 factors and say, well, which elements are making this funny? What is it that this has? He spoke with the wisdom that can only come from experience. Like a guy who went blind because he looked at a solar eclipse without one of those boxes with a pinhole in it, and now goes around the country speaking at high schools about the dangers of looking at a solar eclipse without one of those boxes with a pinhole in it. And I don't even know if this would qualify as a simile. I suppose it was the kid's effort. The little boat gently drifted across the pond exactly the way a bowling ball wouldn't. It's such a disconnect, isn't it? And you look at that, what's expected, right? The expectation versus the reality. And then this actually has several elements, so think about this one. McBride fell 12 stories, hitting the pavement like a hefty bag filled with vegetable soup. A girl could never, ever write that. I mean, but it's got several elements. really. It's got the absurdity element, but then it's got kind of the painful truth element, and then it's got the, you know, just physical humor messiness of the element. From the attic came an unearthly howl. The whole scene had an eerie, surreal quality, like when you're on vacation in another city and Jeopardy comes on at 7 instead of 7:30. Her hair glistened in the rain, like nose hair after a sneeze. This is almost getting to the, you know, disgusting quality. But, you know, you're sitting there, the guy's sitting there, her hair glistened in the rain like what? I mean, what can you compare this to? What else glistens, you know? Can't be rain, and it can't be her hair. It's got to be something completely different. Because if you don't think of something completely different, you get similes like this. Her eyes were two brown circles with big black dots in the center. Or, following along the same genre, her vocabulary was as bad as, like, whatever. Or, he was as tall as a 6'3" tree. So, you know, the kid's trying to just... What's he as tall as? You know, what could we say here? Just desperately trying to pull out of his brain something. And then sometimes you may have seen a movie or had an experience, and to you it would be a reasonable comparison. But to a person who's never seen the thing, it's a total disconnect. The hailstones leaped from the pavement, just like maggots when you fry them in hot grease. Well, you know, and Webster, he said, that kid's been to Africa. Long separated by cruel fate, the star-crossed lovers raced across the grassy field towards each other like two freight trains. Wait, it gets better. One having left Cleveland at 6:36 p.m., traveling 55 miles an hour. The other from Topeka at 4:19, traveling at 45 miles an hour. It's almost as though he just came out of algebra class and he's still like, how do you figure these trains out? Now, this is actually, this doesn't belong on this same list of being funny in my mind, because this is actually a very clever simile. The politician was gone, but unnoticed, like the period after the doctor on a Dr. Pepper can. That's kind of good, isn't it? I mean, it's a little bit disconnect, but we all sit there. We're too busy trying to visualize a Dr. Pepper can to think it's funny. I mean, we never noticed when that thing disappeared. John and Mary had never met. They were like two hummingbirds who had also never met. That, I think, just, it's humorous because it just totally falls short of accomplishing anything at all. This would also be in the genre. The red brick wall was exactly the color of brick red Crayola crayon. This is, I think this kid didn't make this up. I think they found it from a joke or something. Even in his last years, Grandpappy had a mind like a steel trap, only one that had been left out so long it had rusted shut. Yeah, that's actually pretty good. Shots rang out, as shots are wont to do. So that's funny, almost because it's the painful truth that we overuse. He's really pointing out this fact that, you know, shots rang out. Shots couldn't really do anything but ring out. And so that's, I think, a bit clever. This one is hilarious. The plan was simple, like my brother-in-law, Phil. So immediately you've got this double entendre on the word simple. But then he goes on to say, but unlike Phil, this plan might just work. And he's got another double entendre, right? Because the plan might work, but Phil sure doesn't. Poor Phil. The young fighter had a hungry look, the kind you get from not eating for a while. This is great. This is what you do when you cannot think of any original simile, right? You're just stuck with the one you thought of. You can tack on something. He was as lame as a duck. Not the metaphorical lame duck either, but a real duck that was actually lame. And then you get into this absurd imagery that's probably borders on the painful truth element here. She had a deep, throaty, genuine laugh, like that sound a dog makes just before it throws up. The knife was as sharp as the tone used by Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat, Texas, in her first of several points of parliamentary procedure made to Representative Henry Hyde, Republican, Illinois, in the House Judiciary Committee hearings on the impeachment of President William Jefferson Clinton. What were we applying this to? You've just, you know, transferred to a whole different universe. There was a knife. The dandelion swayed in the gentle breeze, like an oscillating electric fan set on medium. And then you've got some of these, and you just think, I am never going to forget this one. And so if you love ballet and you want to love ballet for the rest of your life, just plug your ears up for this one. The ballerina rose gracefully on point and extended one slender leg behind her, like a dog at a fire hydrant. No, I tell you, you're never going to walk into a ballet and watch that thing and not think about this darn fire hydrant. He was deeply in love when she spoke. He thought he heard bells, as if she were a garbage truck backing up. Beep, beep, beep. She walked into my office like a centipede with 98 missing legs. It hurt the way your tongue hurts after you accidentally staple it to a wall. You know. Anyway, similes by high school students. So when you start to listen to humor, hopefully this will give you a bit of a quality. When you start to look for, some good jokes to bring into your classroom, start off your school year. I look at some moms, and they are at a convention, and these people have got an embedded grimace. Have you ever met people? Even when they try to smile, it doesn't work because they've just been so serious for so long. And one of the talks I give on, it's the teaching boys and other kids who make forts all day. I tell the little story of my daughter who came with me to a writing class, and she said, "Oh, Daddy, that was wonderful." And I felt, oh, I'm good. And then she said, "How come you're not like that at home?" Right? And I tell how easy it is for us to be nice and friendly and humorous and relaxed with other people's children, and how easy it is to forget to be nice and relaxed and humorous with your own children. And so I tell some of these moms, you know, before you spend money on another curriculum, you go learn how to get that permanent grimace off your face. Because until you do that, going to be very hard to make anything, even if it's brilliant like our system, work with your kids. And you teach yourself. Garrison Keillor, I think, summed it all up. Garrison Keillor said this. He said, jokes are democratic. Anyone can learn to tell jokes. It requires no specialized skill, no special aptitude, no degree, no units in certain classes. Anyone can learn to tell jokes. And it's a knack that will be useful your whole life. Because let's face it, trigonometry and physics are not entirely practical for most people. However, being able to tell a good joke is always helpful. So in a way, I agree with Garrison Keillor that if you were to enable yourself and your children with one lifetime valuable skill, it would be the aptitude for humor in their teaching, humor in life.
Thanks for listening. Do you have questions or comments? Please contact the Institute for Excellence in Writing at 1-800-856-5815 or visit our website, IEW.com.